This is an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. I'm Jorge Fascinetti. Welcome. In today's podcast, Dr. Luis Blevins discusses growth hormone secreting pituitary adenomas. This is the third podcast of this series on pituitary tumors. Here's Dr. Blevins.
Good evening. This is Dr. Luis Blevins of Pituitary World News. And I want to talk to you today about growth hormone secreting pituitary adenomas. These tumors are composed of or derived from the growth hormone producing cells in the anterior pituitary gland. They account for anywhere between 12 and 20% of all pituitary adenomas, depending on the clinical center reporting their experiences. So they do represent a small proportion of all pituitary tumors seen by clinicians practicing pituitary endocrinology. There are a number of different types of growth hormone secreting pituitary tumors. The first ones secrete pure growth hormone. About 15 to 30% of these tumors also secrete prolactin. And this is because growth hormone and prolactin cells are derived from a common ancestor cell, and we call that the acidophil stem cell. In fact, some of these tumors are what we refer to as acidophil stem cell adenomas. The next cell type in the lineage of development of growth hormone and prolactin-producing cells is the mammosomatotroph cell, and that's a cell that can produce growth hormone and prolactin. And as you might expect, some of these tumors are actually mammosomatotroph pituitary adenomas. And we know that through immunochemistry, where we can stain these tumors and see that there's one cell producing both of these particular hormones. Some of these growth hormone and prolactin secreting tumors actually are composed of two different cell types, some of them producing growth hormone, others producing prolactin. And then rarely, some patients with genetic disorders that lead to pituitary tumor formation can have a prolactin-producing tumor and a growth hormone-producing tumor in the same pituitary gland at the same time. An even smaller proportion of growth hormone-secreting pituitary tumors also secrete TSH, overdriving the thyroid gland, causing the syndrome of acromegaly and hyperthyroidism. And an even yet smaller group of people also produce growth hormone, TSH, and prolactin. Now, interestingly, if you took a look at all of the tumors that stain positive for growth hormone that the pathologist who does pituitary pathology might encounter over the course of the year, you'll find a proportion of these tumors that were thought to be non-functioning tumors because there was no clinical evidence for hormone hypersecretion actually had growth hormone-producing tumors. Growth hormone producing but not secreting, and thus the IGF-1 levels are normal and the patients do not have the clinical syndrome of acromegaly. The only other disease state to be aware of is that of pituitary hyperplasia due to either growth hormone releasing hormone secretion by a hypothalamic tumor or more commonly due to growth hormone releasing hormone secretion by a neuroendocrine tumor located elsewhere, with the pancreas, the islet cell tumors of the pancreas, in fact, being the most common source of growth hormone releasing hormone from a tumor that's not located in the pituitary gland. These tumors are usually suspected when patients have the clinical syndrome of acromegaly, but their MRI of the pituitary gland shows pituitary enlargement, but no evidence for tumor, and growth hormone releasing hormone levels can be very helpful in that particular situation. Now, a few words about genetics, and I want to mention the genetics here because the growth hormone-producing pituitary tumors have been the ones that are most well studied and understood when it comes to the genetic influence of tumorigenesis. We know that some patients with McCune-Albright syndrome, for example, form nodular hyperplasia and tumors in their pituitary gland that can cause acromegaly. And this disorder is due to a mutation in the G sub S alpha protein that's involved in signal transduction in cells. And this really was a seminal observation that helped us understand some of the mechanisms of tumor formation in pituitary adenomas. Rarely, patients with multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1 will have acromegaly. Acromegaly has been described in the Carney complex And then there are a number of other familial pituitary tumor syndromes, including the AIP mutation syndrome, that can lead to acromegaly as well. The AIP mutation is probably the most notorious of late because of the findings at the Irish Giant, studied by Dr. John Hunter, actually had acromegaly, and studies in the modern age reveal that he had an AIP gene mutation. We know that about 65 to 80% of patients with acromegaly, and this is dependent on the series, will have macroadenomas greater than 1 centimeter in size, whereas the remainders have microadenomas, and a very small number have hyperplasia due to McCune-Albright syndrome or a growth hormone-releasing hormone-secreting pituitary tumor. The larger tumors are often invasive into the bones surrounding the cellex turcica or the cavernous sinuses. But I have also seen small tumors that had an invasive potential. Because of the nonspecific symptoms and signs of acromegaly and the fact that many of these are attributed to aging, some patients with acromegaly have had the disease for a very long time, indicating that these tumors progress over a long period of time. I know one individual who probably had the disease for greater than 25 years. The average in the literature is probably 7 to 8 years before diagnosis. The symptoms and signs of acromegaly are variable from patient to patient, and no two patients with a pituitary adenoma secreting growth hormone are just alike. And this is because there's always a difference in the duration of the disease. The tumors secrete different amounts of growth hormone, even tumors of the same size. And sometimes even when the growth hormone and the IGF-1 levels are identical, there are various tissue sensitivities from patient to patient, so that some patients look very acromegalic and other patients hardly look acromegalic at all. We also know that IGF-1 levels tend to plateau, so that after a certain mean or average growth hormone level, the IGF-1 levels really don't increase very much beyond that. So it's not unusual to see patients with growth hormone levels of 10, for example, and IGF-1 levels of 1,200, or a growth hormone level in another patient of 100 and the IGF level will be 1,200 to 1,300. So once you get to a certain level of IGF-1 generation by the liver, additional growth hormone doesn't result in much higher IGF-1 levels. I have seen IGF-1 levels as high as 1,800, but usually you see the plateau. And it doesn't matter how high the growth hormone level is, the IGF-1 levels will sort of peak out around 1,200 to 1,300. The diagnosis, when suspected based on clinical symptoms and signs, is confirmed by an elevated IGF-1 level. And some physicians employ the use of the oral glucose tolerance test to also make a diagnosis. Oral glucose increases somatostatin tone, and in a normal individual, growth hormone levels fall to less than 0.4 nanograms per milliliter, but in patients with acromegaly, levels will stay higher than that result. I tend to use the oral glucose tolerance test postoperatively if I think a patient might have a small amount of residual tumor, maybe the IGF-1 level is normal, but the growth hormone level is still higher than 1, so I'll employ that test to see whether or not there's pathologic growth hormone secretion, even though the levels appear to be relatively normal. When it comes to growth hormone secretion, keep in mind that most growth hormone secreted by normal pituitary glands occurs at night while we're sleeping and it's pulsatile. But in patients with growth hormone secreting pituitary tumors, the growth hormone is secreted erratically, probably in pulses or packets of growth hormone, but it is an erratic secretion pattern. And it's really the liver and tissue exposures of growth hormone throughout the day that leads to the clinical syndrome of acromegaly. Some believe that mean 24-hour growth hormone levels are more predictive of the severity of the tissue exposure, while others believe that the IGF-1 levels are more reflective of such. In my experience, it's not only, as I mentioned, the absolute value of the levels of these hormones, but also the individual tissue sensitivities, and I do believe that the exposure over time, measured in months and years, is important as well, and how the disease is manifest. as I mentioned, the disease is manifest in a number of different ways with different severities of illness based on a number of different things. And we'll review in a future podcast the symptoms and signs of acromegaly and try to pick some of these apart and share with you some detailed information about the various components of acromegaly, such as sleep apnea, cardiomyopathy, arthropathy, diabetes mellitus, hypertension, cardiomyopathy, etc. Well, I hope this gives you a fairly good general understanding of growth hormone secreting pituitary adenomas. I would encourage you to stay tuned for more and to check out our website, because we have a lot of different articles on acromegaly and the medical therapies for the disorder. And stay tuned for more podcasts on other varieties of pituitary adenomas as time passes. Once again, this is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News. Thank you for listening.
You have been listening to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Don't forget to subscribe to our previews and updates at pituitaryworldnews.org. This is Jorge Facinetti. Thank you for listening.